This is a novel called The Kinsman. It begins in the middle of Africa, in a tiny country named Rwanda. And now part one of The Weaklander. No one goes to Rwanda in the winter. No one goes to Rwanda in the summer. There's no high season, only a low season. It may look like a tropical Switzerland, but no one goes there unless he wants to see death, or maybe even get hacked to death by a machete. Rwanda's the opposite of a resort. Club dead. It's only my first impression, of course. I could be wrong. Call me Yup. That's a baby nickname. Apparently, in an early epoch of my life, I'd say yup about 1,000 times a day. Now I'm 26. I'm a sportsman, a wandering Protestant. I busted out of Yale for grades or the absence of them. I've never done drugs. I have no visible means of support. I'll be okay. I'll never run for the Senate, is all. My Aunt Pearl tells me that I give dilettantism a bad name, whatever that means. And I'm definitely the leading contender for black sheep of a rather austere family made of aunts and uncles and cousins from Middleton, Rhode Island. This is my story. You're not expected to believe it, but you probably ought to, because it's true. I was not having a good day. A couple of weeks before, I'd flown to Nairobi to meet my fiancée, Lauren, for a safari. I tried to catch up with her all through Kenya. We kept crossing paths. I missed her at both game parks. So she left me a note and flew on ahead in the plane I'd chartered to wait for me a few hundred miles south. It seemed like a good idea at the time. And so following my non-safari, I found myself rattling along dirt roads in a condemned Land Rover en route to Tanganyika. It just developed that way. I'd screwed up, I guess. But there I was, being driven south through Rwanda in this discarded UN vehicle that had been sold to my driver, a man who had not yet discovered third gear. And that's how I discovered Rwanda. I was bone weary. We'd been driving over rutted roads, inch by inch. We'd entered Rwanda that morning around dawn. Then about 10 miles below Byumba, we'd been stopped at a roadblock by some fidgety 9-year-old soldiers who were smaller than their guns. My driver, Leopold, became frightened because they couldn't understand my passport. Was I Egyptian? No. Did I have chocolate? No. Then I offered them some nice U.S. dollars, and they accepted them without knowing what they were, and in spite of the fact that I didn't have any chocolate, they allowed us to drive on. I asked Leopold who the hell they were, and he said they were the new government troops, the good guys. Leopold's other name is Asuferwa, and he has a wife and children living next door back in Kenya. He showed me his fear the moment we entered the country, and he stayed edgy the whole time. He definitely did not want to be driving me through there. The only reason he was, he told me every so often, as if I hadn't heard him, was that he needed money to pay for his children's schools in Nairobi. He was constantly imagining Hutu rebels hiding in the tall grass along the road around us. But I'd yet to see my first Hutu, so I wasn't frightened. Now it was afternoon. I'd been shaken into submission. I was played out, parched. It had taken us all day to make probably 80 miles, according to what I could figure out on my map. I couldn't get it out of my head that I'd done this by myself and was here voluntarily. Leopold had bought this Land Rover from the UN for a very cheap price, he told me. I'm sure he did, I told him, because every part of it had been individually condemned. And as if that weren't enough, suddenly the car proved my point, lost its steering and veered off the road. And that was when I got my first glimpse of the reason for Leopold's fear and some of my own. A wire or something had broken. Who knows? I'm no mechanic. So I sat there in the field beside the road, taking pictures of the mountains in the distance while Leopold crawled under the Land Rover. And after a few minutes of doing that, he came over to me. He seemed alarmed. He declared that we'd have to camp where we were overnight, an idea he regarded with cool terror. I was not excited by the idea. He put the car in four-wheel drive and gunned it out of the dip onto level ground, in the high grass and turned the motor off. The fields surrounding us were silent. No bird songs, no roosters, no dogs, no voices. The silence was kind of eerie, and the emptiness of the area, the wide abandoned fields. He was chatting nervously, looking around at the high grass for Hutus. It had grown out of control because of the rain, he said. There had been lots of rain. But not only that, it was because the fields had been abandoned by the farmers. They were very rich fields, he said, even richer than Kenya's for growing coffee and tea and bananas, avocados, all sorts of grain, the works. He couldn't stop talking. The farmers had run away, he said. They were not there anymore, and if they'd stayed, they would have been murdered. I wasn't following any of this. But now, he said, things were being made better, supposed to be anyway. The new regime had taken charge, and the farmers were beginning to come back. And without looking at the sky or anything, he said it would rain that night and that we should try to find shelter. He pointed to an abandoned church we passed half a kilometer back. A little white wooden church, the only building in sight. He said he thought we might be able to sleep in it and cook there. So after watching him tinker with the car for a while, I decided to walk over there. I took my camera. Rustic little white church surrounded by pretty trees. It was still light when I started walking down the wide path. Halfway there, I waved to this little boy lying in the grass. A black boy, for sure. But still, the way he was lying reminded me very much of my cousin Nick because of the way he used to lie on the lawn under the sprinkler summers in Rhode Island when we were kids, when we were 6 or 8. The kid didn't wave back, so I called out, "Hello?" But he still didn't answer. So I figured he must have been taking a nap. I couldn't see it until I walked closer, but his head had been detached from the rest of him, which was turned away from me. But his face was toward me. His eyes closed, and his skin had gone pale, like the kind of papier-mâché mask we used to make at school. He had been dead a while. There were many flies. I can't explain how I felt. It was sort of a seasickness in my face. I was in the presence of death for the first time since my freshman year at Yale, when a kid had jumped from the bell tower. Well, worse, this was murder. I could see that this little boy had been slashed across the back. There was a deep maroon V cut in the top of his head, and one of his hands was missing, nowhere in sight. And he was only this very little boy. But someone with a knife must have been so pissed off at him that he wanted to make sure he would never grow up. And then I saw his hand. I was practically standing on it. I would have known it was a hand. It was so tiny and black, curled up. It looked more like a bird's foot. I waved to Leopold, and he started walking over right away. He was carrying the tire iron. He stared at the boy. I thought he was going to pass out. "What happened to him?" I said. "Machete, machete." He pointed to something a distance away that I hadn't seen. "There's another," he said. Buttocks in the tall grass was all I could see. "Who did it?" "The Hutu. They call these people the Inyenzi," he said. And before I could ask, he added, "It is the Hutu word for cockroach. These people, they are the Batutsi." They used to be Batutsi, now they were garbage. "These Inyenzi, they are the clever ones, the cockroaches, the farmers who own the cows and the fields. And the Hutus are the stupid ones. But there are many, many, many more Hutus." I couldn't think of anything to cover the boy, so we walked down the path to the church. Leopold's fingers were drumming on his legs. His eyes were everywhere. He was terrified. And I was getting there. And halfway to the church, the wind changed and brought us an unfamiliar smell. At first, it smelled like the odor of feces I had smelled when we drove through Malindi. But then it changed. Leopold took my hand. His hand was hard as a root, and together we walked the rest of the way hand in hand. What we smelled was the smell of death. Standing outside the church in a wood shrine was a plaster cast of Jesus Christ holding his arms out, his palms open in a gesture of welcome. But Jesus Christ had not survived well. Little pieces of him had fallen off, and there were crusts of brittle flowers strewn at his feet. The church door had been nailed shut. Leopold pried at it with a tire iron, and we pulled it open. The smell overcame me. Inside was a full congregation, dozens and dozens, more than 100 men, and women and children crammed into its wood pews. It was a horrible mess. All of them were twisted or curled or spread, and some were hanging on to each other, and all were dead and had been dead for maybe weeks. Some had gone pale, like the little boy outside, and some were blacker than lake bottoms. These were the Inyenzi, the cockroaches. They'd been trapped in the church by the Hutus, and they were all dead.